Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to examine the reality of the post-World War II Nazi flight capital operations, this to be contrasted with the popular journalistic fantasies of same. One of the things that is somewhat amusing, at least to yours truly, as well as to other people who are serious students of the Second World War and its aftermath, are the recent, recent spate of stories about the Nazi gold exiting through Switzerland to neutral countries. And indeed, I think that although Switzerland was certainly deeply involved in that Nazi flight capital program, I am of the opinion that the Swiss had been unfairly singled out because the activities that they were involved in were worldwide in scope and involved the United States as much, if not more, than other countries. We're going to begin with our examination of the reality of the Nazi flight capital program with a Wall Street Journal article from April 28th of 1997. This was researched for us by a listener. This is an article entitled, Nazi Money Trail Heats Up 50 Years Later, subtitled, Banks and Nations Are Opening Treasure Trove of Records. It's by Greg Steinmetz of the Wall Street Journal, and it reads in part as follows. According to testimony after World War II, an SS officer named Kurt Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R, collected millions of dollars in gold, banknotes, and jewels from Jews seeking to buy their freedom from the Nazis. After the war, Colonel Becker built a successful Bremen-based grain company, Becker GmbH, now owned by Con Agra Incorporated of the U.S. Much of the ransom money was never found, according to the Nazi hunting Simon Wiesenthal Center. Colonel Becker's name is on a list of 234 powerful Germans the Los Angeles-based Wiesenthal Center believes stashed money abroad during the war. It has asked banks in former Nazi havens such as Argentina to open their books and come clean on the Nazi accounts. Quote, you can't have closure until you investigate the perpetrator's account, says Wiesenthal President Rabbi Marvin Heyer. As the fight over Nazi gold intensifies, bringing forth new details on the complicity of supposedly neutral countries with the Germans, the bank matter highlights just how much is still unknown about the Third Reich money trail. Despite a half century of research by historians, it still isn't clear what happened to much of the billions of dollars worth of gold, jewelry, cash, and artworks plundered by the Nazis to finance the war and line their own pockets. And skipping down, one of the central elements in the Nazi flight capital program, as well as the remarkable post-war Bormann organization, about which we will speak in a minute, were some of the neutral countries and indeed some of the corporations that were deeply involved through cartel agreements and standard business arrangements with the major German corporations that underlay the financial and military power of the Third Reich. By the way, I've talked about the incalculably important American corporate connections to Nazism and fascism in numerous programs, including the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, among others. Continuing with this Wall Street Journal article, one of the more complicated gold transactions involved Sweden's wealthy Wallenberg family. After the war started, the Wallenbergs secretly agreed to take over the U.S. arm of Germany's Bosch AG, now known as Robert Bosch GmbH, with the condition that Bosch could buy it back later. American Bosch Corporation in Springfield, Massachusetts, made electronic parts for the U.S. military and thus served as a, quote, kind of intelligence service, unquote, for its German parent, says Dutch writer Gerald Alders, capital A-L-D-E-R-S. Seeing through the arrangement, U.S. officials seized the company in 1942. Bosch bought back the stock to free itself of interest payments promised the Wallenbergs, using Reichsbank gold to pay for it, according to documents unearthed by Swedish journalists. And skipping down, of the Nazi flight capital program, this article alludes to a critical meeting that took place in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine in August of 1944, and that will be our point of departure for the discussion of the remarkable Bormann organization. After it became clear that Germany would lose the war, top Nazis began preparing for a comeback and plotting ways to pay for it. A French double agent who spoke to the Allies claimed that officials from Rheinmetall AG, Krupp AG, now known as Fried Krupp AG Hesch Krupp, Messerschmitt AG, Volkswagen AG, and other companies met at a Strasbourg hotel in August of 1944 to discuss financing plans for the Fourth Reich. Well, as I said, the amusing part or an amusing aspect to the recent coverage of the Nazi gold and the flight capital to neutral countries is that this is not news. This has been known for a long time, and beyond that, the reality of the Nazi flight capital program goes infinitely beyond anything that has been discussed in any of these stories. And in fact, the Nazi flight capital program resulted in the successful establishment and, in my analysis, I believe ultimately the triumph of the Underground Reich. Now, that'll sound like absolute drivel to the uninitiated. The fact of the matter is, as I've documented in numerous programs, notably RFA 37, the Third Reich did not disappear but went underground after the Second World War, following a carefully laid and altogether successful plan. And indeed, if my analysis is correct, I believe that the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, the economic component of the Underground Reich, will ultimately prove to be dominant in human affairs, if it isn't already, and I believe that it will prove to be the critical element in the future history of the world, that is to say, the victorious element in the future history of the world. I believe the future will be theirs. For our analysis of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and its genesis, we're going to rely on a remarkable book which perhaps represents to journalism and history as remarkable an accomplishment as the Bormann Organization represents to industry, finance, and to military and political struggle. This book is entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's authored by Paul Manning, who was part of the CBS News team covering World War II, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. The book was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Incorporated. It was copyrighted 1981, and the ISBN number is 0-8184-0309-8. And the story of the Bormann Organization begins with the aforementioned meeting in Strasbourg in August of 1944. And again, this meeting has been known for quite some time. The decision to hold that meeting and the plan for a flight capital organization to reestablish Germany's dominance after the Second World War was laid by Martin Bormann. Bormann, the Reichsleiter, was Hitler's top aide and toward the end of the war became the leader of Nazi Germany and remained the leader of the Underground Reich, literally the Third Reich gone underground. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning writes, Martin Bormann was now, this is in 1944, Martin Bormann was now the leader, in fact, of Germany. Hitler, exhausted, drained of the charisma of the glory days of the 30s and the conquest years of the early 40s, was going through the gestures of military leadership mechanically as his troops fell back on all fronts. Martin Bormann, 41 at the fall of Berlin and strong as a bull, was at all times at Hitler's side, impassive and cool. His be-all and end-all was to guide Hitler, and now to make the decisions that would lead to the eventual rebirth of his country. Hitler, his intuitions at peak level despite his crumbling physical and mental health in the last years of the Third Reich, realized this and approved of it. Bury your treasure, he advised Bormann, for you will need it to begin a Fourth Reich, unquote. That is precisely what Bormann was about when he set in motion the flight capital scheme August 10, 1944 in Strasbourg. The treasure, the golden ring he envisioned for the new Germany, was the sophisticated distribution of national and corporate assets to safe havens throughout the neutral nations of the rest of the world. Martin Bormann knew in his heart that the war in Germany was over when Normandy was lost. The day Hitler's troops were defeated at the Falaise Gap was the day he ordered swing industrialists of Germany to Strasbourg to hear his plans for Germany's future. And Paul Manning writes of this meeting in Strasbourg as follows. Reichsleiter Martin Bormann himself had ordered the conference, and although he would not physically be present, he had confided to Dr. Scheid, at S-C-H-E-I-D, who was to preside, quote, the steps to be taken as a result of this meeting will determine the post-war future of Germany, unquote. The Reichsleiter had added, quote, German industry must realize that the war cannot now be won and must take steps to prepare for a post-war commercial campaign which will in time ensure the economic resurgence of Germany, unquote. It was August 10, 1944. The Mercedes-Benz bearing SS Obergruppenführer Scheid moved slowly now through the narrow streets of Strasbourg. Dr. Scheid noticed that this was the most agreeable city, the one to return to after the war. And skipping down of the meeting, Manning writes, a transcript of that meeting is in my possession. It is a captured German document from the files of the U.S. Treasury Department and states who was present and what was said as the economy of the Third Reich was projected onto a post-war profit-seeking track. By the way, this document emerged as part of Operation Safe Haven, an Allied intelligence operation aimed at interdicting the Third Reich's flight capital. That operation was itself interdicted when the residue of the Third Reich allied with the United States, Britain, and France in the post-war period. That alignment, of course, against the former Soviet Union. Continuing, of the meeting, Manning writes. Present were Dr. Kaspar, representing Krupp, Dr. Tolle, representing Rochling, Dr. Sincerin, representing Messerschmitt, Drs. Kopp, Veer, and Berwanger, representing Rheinmetall, Captain Haberkorn and Dr. Ruhe, representing Busing, Drs. Ellenmayer and Cardos, representing Volkswagenwerk, Engineers Drosse, Janchu, and Kopschem, representing various factories in Posen, Poland, Drosse, Janchu and Company, Braun Boveri Herculeswerke, Buchswerke, and Stadtwerke, Dr. Meyer, an official of the German Naval Ministry in Paris, and Dr. Stroessner of the Ministry of Armament, Paris. By the way, I may be mispronouncing some of these names. I don't speak German. Continuing. Dr. Scheidt, papers from his briefcase arranged neatly on the table before him, stated that all industrial materiel in France was to be evacuated to Germany immediately. The Battle of France is lost to Germany, he admitted, quoting Reichsleiter Bormann as his authority, and again quoting, and now the defense of the Siegfried Line and Germany itself is the main problem. From now on, German industry must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, with each industrial firm making new contacts and alliances through foreign firms. This must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. However, the party and the Third Reich will stand behind every firm with permissive and financial support, unquote. He assured those present that the frightening law of 1933 known as Treason Against the Nation, which mandated the death penalty for violation of foreign exchange regulations or concealing of foreign currency, was now null and void on direct order of Reichsleiter Bormann. Dr. Scheidt also affirmed, quote, the ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war, unquote. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheidt cited the fact that, quote, patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern, unquote. He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. By the way, I would note that these complicated corporate and cartel connections and their profound influence on the growth of the Third Reich are discussed in, among other programs, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. I would also note that the Bush family was deeply involved, that's the family of George Bush, with the Hamburg America Line. Continuing of Dr. Scheidt's address, he gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Glancing at his watch, Dr. Scheidt asked for comments from each of the 12 around the table. Then he adjourned the morning session for lunch. And at the afternoon session, Dr. Scheidt also discussed the plans for the industrial concerns of Germany abroad to basically serve as a base for the continuation of the Nazi Party underground, both abroad and in Germany, and also mentioned that, also analyzed correctly, that many of the leaders of the Third Reich would be viewed as war criminals after the war, and that they were to be placed with various German firms abroad. Of this, Manning writes, a smaller conference in the afternoon was presided over by Dr. Bosse of the German Armaments Ministry. It was attended only by representatives of HECO, Krupp, and Rochling. Dr. Bosse restated Bormann's belief that the war was all but lost, but that it would be continued by Germany until certain goals to ensure the economic resurgence of Germany after the war had been achieved. He added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France. And skipping ahead, from this day, German industrial firms of all rank were to begin placing their funds and, wherever possible, key manpower abroad, especially in neutral countries. Dr. Bosse advised that, quote, two main banks can be used for the export of funds for firms who have made no prior arrangements, the Basler Handelsbank and the Schweizerische Kreditanstalt of Zurich, unquote. He also stated, again quoting, there are a number of agencies in Switzerland which, for a 5% commission, will buy property in Switzerland for German firms using Swiss cloaks. Dr. Bosse closed the meeting, observing that, quote, After the defeat of Germany, the Nazi Party recognizes that certain of its best-known leaders will be condemned as war criminals. However, in cooperation with the industrialists, it is arranging to place its less conspicuous but most important members with various German factories as technical experts or members of its research and designing offices, unquote. And one of the central aspects in the German flight capital operation, and it was very successfully realized, were the profound corporate connections between the large German corporations and their counterparts in other countries, including and especially the United States. Central among those German corporations, with its net of cartel agreements with foreign corporations, was the powerful and landmark IG Farben company, the German dyestuffs industry, one of the most important industrial concerns in the history of free enterprise. Continuing with Manning's account of IG Farben's role in the flight capital program, Manning writes, IG Farben had been the largest single earner of foreign exchange for Germany during the years of the Third Reich. Its operations in Germany included control of 380 companies with factories, power installations, and mines, as well as vast chemical establishments. It operated in 93 countries, and the sun never set on IG Farben, which had a participation both acknowledged and concealed in over 500 firms outside Germany. They grew, as the Third Reich did, and as German armies occupied each country in Europe, they were followed by Farben technicians who built further factories and expanded the IG investment to 7 billion Reichsmarks. The Farben cartel agreements involving trade and the related use of its chemical patents also numbered over 2,000, including such major industrial concerns as Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, the Aluminum Company of America, by the way, that's Alcoa, E.I. DuPont de Nemours, that of course is DuPont, Ethyl Export Corporation, Imperial Chemical Industries of Great Britain, the Dow Chemical Company, Roman Haas, Establishment Kuhlmann in France, and the Mitsui interests of Japan. IG Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann as his plans in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would be what the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries, beginning again. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general and to IG in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG would be so great that despite German defeat, IG, in one way or another, could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. Quote, they will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories, as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves, he further told Bormann, adding that he and other industrialists such as Hermann Röchling, quote, do not think much of Hitler's recent declaration of a scorched earth policy for Germany. Destruction of our factories will surely inhibit Germany's recovery in the post-war world, he affirmed. Bormann pondered this exchange with von Schnitzler. It was then that he determined to countermand Hitler's order for the ruthless destruction of German industry. He was aware also that the Gauleiters, the regional political supervisors and area commanders of the party who reported to him as party chief, shared the same view as expressed by Dr. von Schnitzler. By the way, I would note in passing that one of the aspects that made the German flight, the Bormann flight capital program so successful was the fact that as the Nazis conquered various countries in Europe, their economies were basically grafted on to the German economy so that the German corporations retained control of the major corporations of the countries Germany had conquered even after the war. And again, the cartel agreements of the various large German corporations, IG Farben among them, in particular their cartel agreements with American corporations, were front and center to the operations of the flight capital program, one of the reasons that I think the condemnation of Switzerland is quite hypocritical. One of the things that Martin Bormann did in order to assure the success of the flight capital program was to set up 750 new corporations in neutral countries to handle the flight of the assets of the Third Reich. Paul Manning writes about this as follows. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the direction of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz. By the way, that's Hermann Schmitz of IG Farben, one of the luminaries of the IG, just like Dr. von Schnitzler. Continuing. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58, Spain, 112, Sweden, 233, Switzerland, 214, Turkey, 35, and Argentina, 98. More about the successful flight of German assets. The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. By the way, I would note that the Merck company, a major German corporation, has been one of the major corporations involved with the U.S. post-World War II biological warfare program. It is also one of the largest manufacturers of vaccines in the world. It dispenses vaccines to the United States Army, and it also manufactured the experimental hepatitis B vaccine program, which many believe was responsible for the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. Continuing. Of the 750 companies and the holding companies for these major German corporations, Manning writes, a holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America, a control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership. In Switzerland, the most substantial investments were in chemicals and drugs, and in electric power and equipment. German investments totaled $300 million, of which bank deposits, cash, and securities amounted to about $250 million, with direct investments about $50 million. In the German-Swiss clearings, Germany's debt, as the new year of 1945 began, was 1,000 million Swiss francs, or $232.1 million. Swiss investments in Germany and pre-war loans to Germany were $445 million. Six Swiss private banks were now used by German firms in the flight capital program. H. Stutzenegger and C., Rochling & Company, Johann Verli & Company, Bank Wadenswil, Basler Handelsbank, and Kreditanstalt. Again, I may be mispronouncing some of these names. However, all major Swiss banks were serving the Germans in the massive movement of funds. The big German banks, Deutsche, Dresdner, and Commerzbank, all had their regular Swiss affiliations through which they worked. Deutsche had as its principal connection Credit Suisse and also did business with the Swiss Bank Corporation and the Bank Federal. Banks transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered accounts, or funds transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered accounts and were either held there for local investment or soon shifted to neutral nations elsewhere in Europe or overseas to be credited to the accounts of appropriate German corporate subsidiaries or else to entirely new corporations awaiting these startup monies that would enable them to go into business using German patents. As these new corporations prospered, they generated more money and profits, becoming important elements in the Bormann global economic scheme. I would also note that one of the things that the Bormann Flight Capital Organization did very successfully was to acquire control over assets in the United States, and again, some of the cartel agreements between the major German corporations, which were the foundation of the Third Reich, and their American counterparts were profound. Of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization's acquisitions in America, Manning writes, throughout this period of asset transfer, Reichsleiter Bormann's goal was to have as much foreign exchange as possible in position in all neutral nations in both hemispheres. Aside from the Swiss banks, which made all currencies readily available in exchange for goods, trade, or gold bullion sales, The export of German products to neutral nations added to the general foreign exchange funds. Upon receipt of German goods, an agency in Spain, for example, the Spanish Foreign Exchange Institute, would credit pesetas to a German-controlled import-export company. With such funds accumulating rapidly in Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and Argentina, Bormann and his group, who were handling the fortunes of 750 new corporations, would use these corporations in neutral countries as cloaks for investing in American companies. Bormann always had a high regard for U.S. blue-chip stocks as a stable investment, consistently purchasing a vast number of shares from the European offices of such New York stock brokerage houses as Merrill Lynch on behalf of the Reich Chancellery and Hitler until war became official between the United States and Germany and the buying stopped for a time. In 1941, investments in U.S. corporations by German companies and assorted German individuals held voting ownership in 170, minority ownership was held in another 108 American companies. These businesses covered the following fields: manufacturing, foodstuffs, chemicals, electrical and automobile equipment, machinery and machine equipment, other metal products, petroleum production, refining and distribution, finance, trade, and miscellaneous. American industry, of course, had a financial stake in German industry. In the same year, 1941, 171 U.S. corporations had major investments in German firms amounting to $420 million. A listing of these corporations is identical to the general categories under German ownership in the United States. When Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City: National City, now Citibank; Chase, now Chase Manhattan N.A., Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Bear in mind that Manning is writing here in 1981. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. Indeed, and again, I believe that ultimately, if the history of the world is ever properly written, I believe the Bormann Organization will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs, at least in the 20th and 21st centuries, and it is my analysis that the future ultimately will be theirs. We're going to continue with our analysis of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, one of the most remarkable political, financial, and military achievements of all time, in the next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.